every other totalitarian regime throughout history, marginalize their activities, then lock them up. Prisons are being built, internment camps constructed, and laws passed that deal severely with anyone who dares to step out of line or ask too many questions. There are approximately over 600 prison camps in the U.S., all fully operational and ready to receive prisoners. They are all staffed and even surrounded by full-time guards, but they are all empty. These camps are to be operated by FEMA should martial law need to be implemented in the United States. The camps all have railroad facilities, as well as roads leading to and from the detention facilities. Many also have an airport nearby. The majority of the camps can house a population of 20,000 prisoners. Currently, the largest of these facilities is just outside Fairbanks, Alaska. The Alaskan facility is a massive mental health camp and can hold approximately 2 million people. One possible FEMA camp has been rumored for years to be at an Amtrak train repair center located in Beech Grove, Indiana. While stories and web videos have attempted to report suspicious activities, the conclusion, when honestly investigated, is that there really is not any internment camp there. Approximately 600 employees work there daily. We uncovered no unusual buildings, equipment, or personnel.
Give us the headline, because that's big. If they're making
the top-notch builder supply in Madison, Georgia. To my right, this was previously was a soybean field, and this little new cut road divided this field, and the right side of the road was filled with which I thought was portable toilets. I never looked at them that close. Same in color, maybe black, but which was an odd color. And I was sitting there going over my notes, and a van pulled alongside of me that turned out to be the property owner. And he greeted me, and he was by himself. And so we had a good little dialogue there, and I asked him about the field of black boxes. What were they? Because I'd never seen anything like that. And his statement was that if he told me, I would be one of few people in Madison, Georgia that knew about them. And he says they're disposable coffins, I believe he told me. And he says there's 100, at that time, he said there was 125,000 there. And they were stacked, he told me, 15 high. I asked him who owned them, and he stated that the CDC owned them, and that they were leasing the land, leasing his land for storage. And he said his brother worked with the CDC in Atlanta and had been asked by the CDC to do a 3-year extension to place temporary morgues all across the nation.
So in January of this year, 2005, We decided to drive to beautiful Madison, Georgia, and take a look for ourselves. It was on a Sunday and no one was around, with the exception of this one pickup truck that was coming out the narrow road that we were going in on next to this field. We flagged down the pickup truck, and it was providential that the driver of this pickup truck turned out to be the son of the man that owned this field. So naturally, we started asking him questions. And he told us that not long ago, there had been as many as 500,000 of these grave liners or disposable coffins. We asked him for permission if we could look around, and he said yes, so we did.
We're just getting an idea for the size of these boxes. What could these boxes be used for? Well, they're called casket liners. And that's an interesting term, isn't it? It's a casket liner. When I first heard the term casket liner, I thought perhaps a lining for a casket. But this is too big to be on the inside of a casket. So certainly this could be used as a casket. This is an inexpensive casket. And you can see the size here. There's lots of room. I think my friends here, we could all probably get inside. It might be a little cozy, but we'd fit just fine. Which tells me that these liners can be used for more than just one. And one more time. What kind of liners are these?
Casket liners.
These are casket liners.
That's what the man said.
That's what the man told us. And we're told that there are about... Well, there were about 500,000 out here.
Later, as I went back...
making them go there, that's the beginning of the camps, and is what the Emergency Centers Establishment Act says they would condition people, because at first it'll just be poor people, and then it'll be everybody. What's going on is working poor, where families are living 10 to a house, and now Agenda 21 is trying to ban that.
For the past 8 years, Dan Duvall has run a sober living center for about 30 homeless people on his 72-acre ranch. In California, a 66-year-old man was jailed Monday after being accused of illegally housing homeless people on his ranch in San Luis Obispo.
Would you like to see all the executive orders that have been put into place to take over our nation, to have complete control over us? To take away our rights, round us up, and put us where they want us. Here we go. Executive Order 10990 allows the government to take over all modes of transportation and control of all highways and seaports. Executive Order 10995 allows the government to seize and control the communication media. Executive Order 10997 allows the government to take over all electrical power, gas, petroleum, fuels, and minerals. Executive Order 10998 allows the government to seize all means of transportation, including personal cars, trucks, or vehicles of any kind, and total control over highways, seaports, and waterways. Executive Order 10999 allows the government to take over all food resources and farms. Executive Order 11000 allows the government to mobilize civilians into work brigades under government supervision. Executive Order 11001 allows the government to take over all health, education, and welfare functions. Executive Order 11002 designates the Postmaster General to operate a national registration of all persons. Executive Order 11003 allows the government to take over all airports and aircraft, including commercial aircraft. Executive Order 11004 allows the Housing and Finance Authority to relocate communities, build new housing with public funds, designate areas to be abandoned, and establish new locations for populations. Executive Order 11005 allows the government to take over railroads, inland waterways, and public storage facilities. Executive Order 11051 specifies the responsibility of the Office of Emergency Planning and gives authorization to put all executive orders into effect in times of increased international tensions and economic or financial crisis. Executive Order 11310 grants authority to the Department of Justice to enforce the plan set out in executive orders, to institute industrial support, to establish judicial and legislative liaison to control all aliens, to operate penal and correctional institutions, and to advise and assist the president. Executive Order 11049 assigns emergency preparedness function to federal department and agencies, consolidating 21 operative executive orders issued over a 15-year period. Executive Order 11921 allows the Federal Emergency Preparedness Agency to develop plans to establish control over the mechanisms of production and distribution of energy sources, wages, salaries, credit, and the flow of money in U.S. financial institution in any undefined national emergency. It also provides that when a state of emergency is declared by the president, Congress cannot review the action for 6 months. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has broad powers in every aspect of the nation. General Frank Salzito, chief of FEMA's Civil Security Division, stated in a 1983 conference that he saw FEMA's role as a new frontier in the protection of individual and governmental leaders from assassination and of civil and military installations from sabotage and or attack, as well as prevention of dissident groups from gaining access to U.S. opinion or a global audience in times of crisis. FEMA's powers were consolidated by President Carter to incorporate the National Security Act 1947 that allows for strategic relocation of industries, services, government, and other essential economic activities, and to rationalize the requirements for manpower, resources, and production facilities. The 1950 Defense Production Act gives the President sweeping powers over all aspects of the economy. The Act of August 29, 1916 authorizes the security of the Army in time of war to take possession of any transportation system from transporting troops, material, or any other purpose related to the emergency. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act enables the president to seize the property of a foreign country or national. These powers were transferred to FEMA in a sweeping consolidation in 1979. There you have it. Everything is set into place. They've begun throwing the poor, the homeless, into the prison camps, the FEMA camps. Now all they have left to do is take the guns.
Mr. and Mrs. America, turn them all in.
$6 billion tons. For each American, it's about 20 tons. For people in poor countries, it's less than 1 ton. It's an average of about 5 tons for everyone on the planet. And somehow we have to make changes that will bring that down to zero. It's been constantly going up. It's only various economic changes that have even flattened it at all. So we have to go from rapidly rising to falling and falling all the way to zero. This equation has four factors, a little bit of multiplication. So you've got a thing on the left, CO2, that you want to get to zero. And that's going to be based on the number of people, the services each person's using on average, the energy on average for each service, and the CO2 being put out per unit of energy. So let's look at each one of these and see how we can get this down to zero. Probably one of these numbers is going to have to get pretty near to zero. That's back from high school algebra. But let's take a look. First, we've got population. The world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%. But there we see an increase of about 1.3. The second factor is the services we use. This encompasses everything. The food we eat, clothing, TV, heating. These are very good things. Getting rid of poverty means providing these services to almost everyone on the planet. And it's a great thing for this number to go up. In the rich world, perhaps the top 1 billion, we probably could cut back and use less. But every year, this number on average is going to go up. So this is a wish. It's a very concrete wish that we invent this technology. If you gave me only one wish for the next 50 years, I can pick who's president, I can pick a vaccine, which is something I love, or I could pick that this thing that's half the cost with no CO2 gets invented. This is the wish I would pick. This is the one with the greatest impact. If we don't get this wish, the division between the people who think short-term and long-term will be terrible, between the U.S. and China, between poor countries and rich.
So we'll do the same format. It'll be 3 minutes, and then time for questions. We'll start with Mr. Chaitkin.
Anton Chaitkin. I'm a historian and the history editor for Executive Intelligence Review. President Obama has put in place a reform apparatus reviving the euthanasia of Hitler Germany in 1939. That began the genocide there. The apparatus here is to deny medical care to elderly, chronically ill, and poor people, and thus save, as the president says, $2 to $3 trillion by taking lives considered not worthy to be lived, as the Nazi doctors said. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel and other avowed cost cutters on this panel also lead a propaganda movement for euthanasia headquartered at the Hastings Center, of which Dr. Emanuel is a fellow. They shape public opinion and the medical profession to accept a death culture such as the Washington state law passed in November to let physicians help kill patients whose medical care is now rapidly being withdrawn in the universal health disaster. Dr. Emanuel's movement for bioethics and euthanasia and this council's purpose directly continue the eugenics movement that organized Hitler's killing of patients and then other costly and supposedly unworthy people. Dr. Emanuel wrote last October 12th that a crisis, war, and financial collapse would get the frightened public to accept the program. Hitler told Dr. Brandt in 1935 that the euthanasia program would have to wait until the war began to get the public to go along. Dr. Emanuel wrote last year that the Hippocratic Oath should be junked. Doctors should no longer just serve the needs of the patient. Hoche and Binding, the German eugenicists, exactly said the same thing to start the killing. You on the council are drawing up the procedures, the list to be used to deny care, which will kill millions if it goes ahead in the present world crash. You think, perhaps, the backing of powerful men, financiers, will shield you from accountability, but you are now in the spotlight. Disband this council and reverse the whole course of this Nazi revival now.
Thank you. A quick break. I'm going to ask for questions and comments. Ms. Zuckerman, if you can come up, and I'm opening it up to the panel.
Thank you.
Yes, we're still going to, Ms. Williams, you're still going to get to talk. I'm going to ask Ms. Zuckerman to come up and join you. We're going to take a quick stop in the panel to open it up for comments or questions because we have a few folks who have to potentially go. The whole transcript will be available, though, and all comments will be shared with all council members. I apologize that I have to go back to an important meeting. I do want to just clarify one thing about my own, since my reputation has been besmirched here, is I think I do have a very long record of writing against the legalization of euthanasia. So the association of me and that seemed a little strange given, I don't know, at least 30 years or 25 years of writing on the topic against the legalization. So just to clarify the record for everyone in the room, thank you.
Can we?
You said that you're opposed to assisted suicide, but that you are in favor of the withdrawal of medical care, which accomplishes the same thing. So you had this article with Margaret Batten, who is an accomplished.
So, sir, it's a. So it's not a. Your statement was read into the record. It's not the time for debate, but we appreciate your comments. And we apologize for the break in the panel, but we just wanted to. Have that break.
Stabilization. Rick, we appreciate your joining us.
Thank you, Laura.
Rick, what does population stabilization mean, and how do you seek to enforce that?
Well, we're not the Ecodomes of Malthus, as some would have you believe, but the world population is a concern. The Associated Press just has an article today saying that the world population is going to reach 7 billion people by the year 2012. We're 6.7 billion people today. And so, you know, what it means for Americans is unrestrained population growth. I'm a baby boomer. I was born in the middle of the last century. The population in the country has doubled in my lifetime. Those kids in high school today are going to see a half a billion people living in America. And the question we're asking is, why do we need to have this growth and where is it coming from? And we've located the source. About
right.
Over 80% of it is coming from immigration
right.
and the children that immigrants have.
Okay, so what do you propose? I'm going to go back to the basics here because I'm just going to like let you carry on with this crazy idea that people are bad and we should have fewer of them because I actually like people. I want to have more people. But let's say you're right, okay? How do you enforce your worldview? Is this an international body that somehow mandates population growth? I mean, China's trying that with its one-child policy, and then after the big natural disaster there, they're going, maybe this isn't such a good idea after all. We're going to lose population.
Our concern is about American population growth and, of course, California. The 37 million people in California today are going to be 60 million people in the next 2 to 3 decades.
So you have no idea.
And so,
Rick, I can't. This is
so,
driving me crazy. You're driving me crazy.
Our
Do
idea
you
is
have
this.
A plan,
to,
Rick? You, no, you're spouting
yes.
off things from an office in California. This is my question. You're saying something very controversial here, and I hope people understand what you're saying. You think there should be fewer people in the United States. I'm trying to figure out which people are the undesirables. And you pointed out you think immigrants
oh my
are undesirable.
God.
I guess illegal immigrants are undesirable, and all those children they have are undesirable. And, you know, I don't want illegal people here, but I don't want people to be killed either. So my question to you is, with your worldview,
this is unbelievable.
How do you enforce this one child per person utopia? How do you do it? Enough with the spouting. I don't want to hear that.
We don't use the word undesirable. What we want to do is to see the immigration laws enforced to cut down the numbers of the influx of illegal aliens into the country, which is driving almost all of the population growth in this country. We want the immigration laws enforced. We don't feel that it's a fair trade-off to leave open borders so employers can have access to cheap labor and to overpopulate the country for the future generation.
Okay, well, you and I agree about illegal immigration. Okay, we agree on one thing, that we need to enforce our borders, enforce our laws. But you go from that to saying, you know, population stabilization, which sounds a lot like population control, which sounds a lot but like this crazy alarmism in the population bomb. I think that wasn't that the book in the 70s. All their predictions turned out to be completely ridiculous and never came to pass. So I want you to be real careful here, Rick, and you don't get into that those very murky waters. I think that's a dangerous place for you to go. You don't have to go that far to argue that America's a sovereign country and we should enforce our borders. I don't think you have to go that far.
Well, that's true. We also don't need to get to the Malthusian apocalypse or the predictions of the population bomb to understand that overpopulation decreases standards of living. We have problems
standards
with healthcare,
education. Standards of living is increasing around the world. People are living longer around the world, Rick. The population, yeah, is going up, but we actually also have people who are being born who come up with cures for diseases, who innovate, who become entrepreneurs, and become, you know, wonderful, loving people who pass down a culture to the next generation. So I would agree with you. You have to manage these things, but the idea that you can somehow through, you know, I guess argument or column writing or whatever it is that you do, that somehow you're going to stop people from having children, I don't think that's the problem. I think it's standing up for your country and sovereignty, and that's fine. Do you see what I'm saying?
Our goal is to remind people that the population continues to grow faster than India or China, and that the source of that population growth is unrestrained immigration and the federal government not enforcing the immigration law. That's what's causing it. People are good. I've heard the argument, waiting for the mythical Mozart. Yes, there's geniuses that haven't been born yet.
Right.
But we're worried about this country and the future generations of this country and what they're going to have to deal with if we don't get control of our borders and our population.
Okay, but why are you focusing on the borders, though? If it's overpopulation, why does the borders even come into it? It's across the board. It's white, brown, and black, right? Or is it just brown-skinned people who you don't think should be born?
Not at all. With us, it's not
the focusing
who, it's
on
the
illegal
many.
Immigration, and I think that gets you into a really, really murky territory. And
Over 80% of our population growth is coming from immigrants and the children they have. That's where we want to see the federal government focus its efforts to enforce the borders and to cut down the numbers that are coming into the country.
Enforce the borders, yes. Don't use words like population stabilization. I get very protective over people living. I appreciate it, though. You're a stand-up guy to join us. And funny man Mike Myers.
Good evening. Our big story tonight. You are so hot, America, and I mean that literally. The temperature was a balmy 60 degrees this afternoon in New York, just outside CNN studios. The average high temperature in December is normally 43. Warm weather's flooded the lower 48 states with 482 daily high temperature records across the country on Monday alone. Quite extraordinary, but is it evidence of man-made global warming? That's tonight's Battleground America. Joining me now are Bill Nye, the science guy, and Mark Morano. He's the publisher of ClimateDepot.com. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you,
Thank you. And
Mark Morano, if I may. You are implacably opposed to the concept of man-made climate change. Why?
We followed the evidence. There are quite literally hundreds of factors that influence global temperature, everything from tilt of the Earth's axis to ocean cycles to water vapor, methane, solar system, the sun, cloud feedback, volcanic dust. The idea that CO2 is the tail that wags the dogs is not supportable. And if you go down and look at the scientific literature, we're finding reams of data and new peer-reviewed studies showing the medieval and Roman warming periods as warm or warmer than today without our CO2 emissions. So what's happened here is the whole movement, because now we've gone 16 years without global warming, according to the UN data, and they've now morphed into extreme weather. And we have the absurd spectacle of people claiming that acts of Congress and the United Nations can control the weather and make hurricanes less nasty and make tornadoes less frequent, which, by the way, none of them are showing any trends at all that are unusual.
Okay, Bill Nye, your response.
Well, we start talking about the facts. Roman warming period, those are just in Europe, and they're not representative.
Let's see if we can
agree on a couple things. Do you agree that when I was a kid or when you were a kid, there was 340 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Sure, carbon dioxide's rising. What's your point?
Okay.
No.
So here's the point, is it's rising extraordinarily fast. That's the difference between the bad old days and now. It's much faster than ever in history. And so
let him finish.
It's the rate that's of great concern more than the actual
and what do you put that rate down to, Bill?
Oh, it's human activity. I mean, you go back, this is what I say all the time. So you look in the ice and you find bubbles of trapped gas from 200 years ago, let alone 1,000 years ago. There's nobody running around with a hypodermic needle injecting bubbles of gas in ancient ice cores. I mean, that's the ancient atmosphere in there. And so you can determine the composition of the ancient atmosphere exactly. This medieval warming period is brought up quite often, but it was really a European phenomenon, and it wasn't global.
And what are the biggest factors, the man-made factors, creating the acceleration of CO2 in the atmosphere?
The biggest thing is, when I was 9 years old, the Earth's population changed from 2.999 billion to 3 billion. Now it's, in my lifetime, it's now 7 billion people trying to live the way we lived in the developed world. And it's just, we're just burning carbon and spewing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at an extraordinary rate.
Right, so Mark Morano, if there is a massively increased acceleration in CO2 in the atmosphere, at the same time that there's been a bigger than double the sizing of the population of the planet, why would that not be inexorably linked? Explain to me.
Well, CO2 is rising. No one's disputing that. What Bill Nye just did was waste everyone's time explaining that CO2 is rising. The question is, what impact does CO2 have on the weather? What impact does CO2 have on climate change? And that is where you look at the geologic record. We've had warmer periods where it's been with lower CO2, and we've had colder periods with higher CO2. And you have to go way back for some of that. But the bottom line is, hundreds of factors are dictating our climate. The medieval warm period was both southern and northern hemisphere. On my website, it demolishes the idea of a hockey stick, new peer-reviewed studies. So the idea that Bill Nye is just going around saying CO2 is up, therefore global warming is dangerous, we should be concerned, it's not. It's not dangerous. The bottom line is all these other factors dwarf the effect of CO2.
Let me jump in. How do you explain that the eastern seaboard, for example, is getting some of the warmest weather it's ever had, at the same time that California has been plunged into storm after storm in the last week, and you see that New York last month had the worst hurricane it's ever endured, and so on and so on.
Sure.
How do you explain that we're getting so many of these freakish weather patterns if at the same time you've got all this extra CO2 in the atmosphere and all these people now guzzling up power and energy and emitting gases that weren't there before?
No.
Surely that is evidence, isn't it?
No, you go to the peer-reviewed literature. You're looking at anecdotal evidence. This is now the level of your daily horoscope. Basically, global warmists like Bill Nye say, global warming will cause many bad weather events. And guess what? Bad weather events happen all the time. So people look and they say, look, there's more proof. There's a bad weather event. Bottom line, big tornadoes, F3 and larger since the 1950s, have dropped dramatically. Bottom line, we've gone the longest period without a major U.S. Category 3 or larger hurricane hitting the U.S. since at least 1900, maybe the Civil War. Bottom line, new study in the journal Nature, peer-reviewed, no change in U.S. drought in the last 60 years. Bottom line, a new study out shows that drought has not changed in 85 to 126
Okay, let me give you
years.
A minute. Let me add one more bottom line before I defer to Bill Nye. He knows more about this than I do. But another bottom line, the world is indisputably getting warmer. The UN Weather Agency said last week 2012 is on track to become one of the top 10 hottest years on record. Add all the weird climatic changes we're seeing. Bill, over to you.
This will be the hottest two decades in history, in recorded history. And so when you throw around a statement like the UN says it's not the hottest 20 years, I got to disagree with you. Maybe some surface data show that in certain cities.
Well, here's my point to you, Mark, and it's a straightforward one, really. If you are wrong, then the implications for the planet are utterly catastrophic. In other words, if you and the climate change... Well, let me finish. If the anti-climate change brigade win the argument and nothing is done because you convince people nothing needs to be done and you're wrong, then in 100, 200 years will have caused devastation for the planet that will then be irretrievable. If, however, you are right in what you say, and this is unnecessary and overreaction and so on, what you're seeing is a bit of economic hardship in the short term to deal with what may not be as big a problem as you think it is.
Why it's a wrong argument? Because every proposal ever done, including the United Nations Kyoto Protocol, would not even detectably impact the temperatures, assuming you buy into their science.
We're
talking about a climate bill in the United States. President Obama was going around telling people it'll keep the planet 4 or 5 degrees cooler for our grandchildren. His own EPA said it wouldn't affect global CO2 levels, let alone temperature. And if you actually do, right now the developing world's getting 1,000+ coal plants. They are 1.3 billion people don't have running water and electricity. If we actually go the route of trying to stop carbon-based energy, which has been their lifeline, which would lower infant mortality and long life expectancy, it would be the most immoral position you could take. So the bottom line is, even if the skeptics are wrong, the solutions that the global warming alarmists have proposed would have no detectable impact on climate.
Let me let Bill Nye respond to that.
If we were to begin to reduce carbon emissions, have the United States, for example, lead the way in this new technology, especially energy transmission, energy storage, electricity, we could change the world. We could get everybody a much higher quality of life than they'd otherwise have. The problem is so many people live near the coasts, and they're very old economic reasons. People lived on rivers since the beginning of human history. So as the world gets warmer, and I take it he doesn't disagree that the world's getting warmer,
we've warmed
the sea
since the end
actually
of the last
gets
ice
bigger,
age.
And ice so ice is also falling off the ice sheets, so that ice is up on land. So this is also going to cause the sea level to rise. So, for example, in the case of Sandy, which was not an especially big hurricane, the economic impact was $30 billion, and that's in the developed world where we have the resources to deal with it. When you have people displaced on continental scales, we're not talking about a few people trying to get through a fence at a border between countries. We're talking about tens of millions of people trying to move north, trying to move out of Southeast Asia. You're going to have trouble. So the sooner you get started on that problem, the better.
These are all predictions based on climate models. These predictions that Bill's going are based on climate models.
I appreciate your yelling.
81 out of 87 of the basic principles of forecasting.
So, Mark Morano, do you accept that the ocean levels are rising, that the planet is getting hotter, that CO2 emissions have dramatically increased in the last 50 years?
That ice sheets are shrinking?
Ice sheets are shrinking, and that the planet population is doubling and accelerating at a terrifying rate, and that the combination of all these things is likely to be a major problem for the next two or three generations, and therefore doing nothing shouldn't really be a sensible, responsible option.
Doing nothing. First of all, the United States did nothing. Our CO2 emissions are dropping as we move to fracking away from coal through technology. So the idea of doing nothing, there's nothing to do. The idea there's no way you can solve a non-problem. Sea level has been rising since the end of the last ice age. There's no acceleration. Dutch Meteorological Institute said there's no acceleration. You can look at the data, the land-based data. There's no acceleration.
We just don't agree
sea level.
On the facts.
Where so it goes to anywhere. Scary and where the horror story is are in all these predictions. And they come out and say it's worse
well,
than we thought.
I respect,
why? Because
look,
the predictions get scarier and scarier.
Okay, look, I respect that you have views. I don't think they're facts. And there are many scientists who would take issue with you about the use of the word fact.
Jack,
I'm
going
to have to wrap it up, I'm afraid. It's been a spirited debate, and I appreciate you both coming on. To
thank you.
Mark Morano and Bill Nye, I'm sure it will rumble on. Thank you.
Ironically, however, the very innovations that are making possible dramatic improvements in human well-being are also creating new problems which raise the specter of an alarming and possibly catastrophic disaster to the biosphere we live in. And herein lies the dilemma that we all face. Let me illustrate. Improved public health has caused the world's infant mortality rate to decline by 60% over the last 40 years. In the same period, the world's average life expectancy has increased from 46 years in 1950s to 63 years today. This is a development which, as individuals, we can only applaud. However, the result of these positive measures is a world population that has risen during the same short period of time geometrically to almost 6 billion people and could easily exceed 8 billion by the year 2020. The negative impact of population growth on all of our planetary ecosystems is becoming appallingly evident. The rapid growing exploitation of the world's supply of energy and water is a matter of deep concern, and the toxic byproducts of widespread industrialization have increased atmospheric pollution to dangerous levels. Unless nations will agree to work together to tackle these cross-border challenges posed by population growth, overconsumption of resources, and environmental degradation, the prospects for a decent life on our planet will be threatened. The recent UN meeting in Cairo is appropriately focused on one of these key issues, population growth. But the controversies which have erupted at the conference illustrate the problem of coming to grips with issues that are deeply divisive and which have a profound moral dimension. The United Nations can and should play an essential role in helping the world find a satisfactory way of stabilizing world population and stimulating economic development in a manner that is sensitive to religious and moral considerations. Economic growth is, of course, an inevitable corollary of a growing population and is essential to improved standards of living. But without careful coordination, unrestrained economic growth poses further threats to our environment. This was a major subject of discussion at the conference in Rio de Janeiro on the environment 2 years ago. The focus then was on sustainable growth and global development. It was pointed out at the conference that growth is most efficiently managed by the private sector, but regulation of the process by national governments and international bodies is also needed. And once again, the United Nations should certainly be among the catalysts and coordinators of this process.
I intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people.
President John F. Kennedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised.
We can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America? The conspiracy theorists are going to go wild.
I'm sure they are. I don't know. I haven't seen the web.
Number 322.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets, Tim, but one thing is not a secret. I disagree with this president's direction that he's taking the country. We can do a better job, and I intend to do it.
And we'll be watching the Safe on the Campaign Trail. John Kerry, thanks for joining us, and we'll be right back.
It's good to be back at the Council on Foreign Relations. As Pete mentioned, I've been a member for a long time and was actually a director for some period of time. I never mentioned that when I was campaigning for re-election back home in Wyoming.
Senator Clinton, how you doing?
Good, how are you
Can
doing?
I ask you a quick question while you sign that?
Sure.
It was reported in June of 2006, you attended a meeting in Ottawa, Canada, the Bilderberg Group. Can you comment on that? What's going on for the Bilderberg meeting, and what do you guys talk about up there?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, you do. I was reported you were up there and people saw you up there. I just want to know what you guys talk about and meet about up there.
Sir, I don't know.
Why are they such top secret meetings?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Your husband went to a Bilderberg meeting too. I'm just wondering. I'm not being rude or anything.
No,
I just want to know what happens at these meetings.
Well, since I wasn't there, I have no idea.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thank you. How are you? There you go.
Thank you very much.
Listen, I am... a happy member of the Bohemian Grove. I like the folks who come there, and it's really inappropriate for me to talk about the group beyond that. Thank you.
Have you been there for the ceremony with the cremation of care?
Frankly, I don't think that's something I need to talk to you about.
Have you been there for the ceremony with the cremation of care?
Frankly, I don't think that's something I need to talk to you about.
Really?
That's right.
Well, I'm Alex Jones, and I snuck in there in 2000. I'm the guy that blew it wide open.
And got the video. It's been on national TV.
Well, I disrespect you for that.
You do?
I do.
But it's a lot of big public officials going in there.
Don't
we deserve to know?
You took an I don't know anything about you, and I don't know anything about your film. But if you go in there with an understanding, you violated that understanding by releasing that film, and I don't respect you for that.
Really?
I'm sorry, you took an understanding when you went in there that you would not do that film. And did you have an understanding when you went in there?
No.
Did you crash it?
Yes.
Yeah, and it has no trespassing signs there, too, doesn't it?
No, they put them on the bathroom.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, sir. I've been there before. I know what the circumstances are, and I'm sorry you violated the understanding. But it was not, that was not a gentlemanly thing to do.
But what about the ritual? Is the ritual gentlemanly?
Sir, everything. I don't owe you this comment. This is what's called ambush journalism, and I disrespect you for that as well. So thank you.
You ever,
and goodbye.
You ever
the ritual? Let's leave your damn business.
Oh. That's why they go to places like Bohemian Grove, sacrifice children to spirits in front of a 40-foot owl.
We're headed back to the Marriott here in Chantilly, Virginia, the scene of Bilderberg 2008. We've successfully infiltrated the last day and a half inside, got out with some great stuff. We've been tailed, and now we're going back to cover the dignitaries, the elitist, as they arrive. And right now is the prime time for them to start arriving for the next 3-4 hours. We took about a 30-minute break. I'm sure we missed a few, but it doesn't matter. We've got scores of people that just organically are listeners, InfoWarriors, that are out here taking action.
The next 3 days, while you try to chart the future of our destiny, we're taking our destiny back. You're not our gods or our masters.
We witnessed at least 7 convoys of armed Secret Service entering the Westfields Marriott, and internal sources confirmed that both candidates did attend at least one meeting inside the conference. While the Bilderberg Group was 100% successful in 2008 at keeping their name out of the mainstream media, they did not fare as well when it came to the exploding independent press. During the entire 2-day event, anti-New World Order pro- The global elite are desperate to keep their organizational meetings a secret. They are keenly aware that if the population discovers that policy is being developed covertly by powerful special interest, the people will revolt.
It is our duty to expose these criminals. It's a criminal act under federal law for federal officials to have private meetings to discuss world policy with non-federal workers. So everybody from the State Department, Treasury Department, White House, Defense Department, and others who show up, as they always do, they're committing a criminal act simply by being here to attend a secret meeting with officials from other countries to discuss U.S. policy in the world. So literally, it's a criminal act. And every newspaper, every broadcaster has a patriotic duty to expose these scum and the evil they project.
The election primaries served as a great diversion while the true future course of the nation was being set behind closed doors.
You've got, obviously, the Bilderberger Group founded by the former Nazi Prince Bernhard of Holland. You've got the Trilateral Commission founded by David Rockefeller's Zbigniew Brzezinski. They're the ones who ran the Carter administration. Everybody in the Carter administration, from Carter and Mondale and Volcker and Brzezinski, were all members of the Trilateral Commission.
This is Bernanke, man. Bernanke, you're going down!
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founding.
It's no secret that a massive shift in global economic power is underway from west to east. But the question is whether the old developed economies are ready for the consequences of that change.
We've got to give them a stake in creating the kind of world order that I think all of us would like to see.
Are we at one of those moments in history in which there is the necessity for a new world order? A, because of what's taken place in the Middle East, the rise of different kinds of groups, and B, what's happened in Asia, meaning that there has been a shift from the West to the East.
There's a need for a new world order, but it has different characteristics in different parts of the world.
Are you optimistic a global system can happen from what we've heard so far?
It could happen, and in fact it's in the works.
Issues, but they really are issues of the construction of a new world order. That's what this is about. And that's the sort of dialogue the Chinese are generally good at. And so a partnership between us is essential. A conflict between us is going to exhaust us both. In tactical exercises, it cannot be conclusive.
Order could satisfy both.
It has to satisfy both, because otherwise it will lead to tensions that will exhaust us both.
Secretaries of the European Union, representatives of our NATO alliance, distinguished guests. We meet here at a moment of testing for Europe and the United States, and for the international